tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So how y'all doing? You recovered from Christmas and New Year's? And did you have a good time on Christmas? Mm-hmm. Spend time with family? Some of you didn't do anything? Spend time with family. It's question and answer night, you know. So I'm going to see if you can talk. I'm presuming you have some questions and answers, or comments, or complaints, or...
Did you see the moon at 6 tonight?
The what? So
did you see the moon at 6 tonight?
No.
Just a little sliver, but you could see the whole sphere at the same time.
How beautiful.
Quite delightful.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Yeah, Spong, he's talking about and one of the many, many things he discusses is the experience of Homo sapiens and of humans, and saying that there aren't really humans until there's self-consciousness, right? And self-consciousness is the ability to live in history, he says. Because you know a past and you can project into a future. And you can do that because you have language. You can abstract your experience into language. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you can communicate, therefore you can think, therefore, right? So therefore you are separate from, as an observer. Does that make sense? I think it's the best definition I've ever heard. And yet there is a longing to not be separate. How to become conscious of the unconscious. How to move beyond the limits of fear that get set up when you have self-consciousness. Does that make sense? You know, when you first have self-consciousness and you're learning how to walk, you're willing to go anywhere as long as one of your parents is with you. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that, those of you who raised kids or who've been around kids? But if your parents disappear and you haven't yet got familiar with your yard, it's a real freak out because it's other. Mm-hmm. You need that recognition. Hi there. So the whole kind of quality of self-consciousness and language is what makes humans distinct and memory, like living in time, language, memory. Well, look who you brought. How nice to see you. It's been a long time. You've been in California. I bet tonight you almost wish you were there. Although it snowed there, didn't it?
Yeah,
there
was a really big freeze. I'm all freaking out because
Oh, that's right. That's right. It's different there when it freezes. Nice to see you. It's question and answer night. Nobody has any questions and answers, so I'm just rambling about the latest book I've read. Mm-hmm.
Which ones?
John Spong, do you know Spong?
Mm-hmm.
He was at one time the Archbishop of an Anglican church in the States, and then he retired. But while he was still an Archbishop, he made a lot of headlines because, hi Bob, Happy New Year, nice to see you. Got a chair back there?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. Are you going to come up here and grab a wall? There's a wall there by Dawn.
There's a wall.
Dawn can move a bit. Make a wall.
Excuse me.
And take one of those flat cushions underneath you. Give him a cushion. You okay?
Yep.
All right. He looks kind of good next to the teachers in the shrine, doesn't he? Oh, that works. So I'm just talking about this book I've been reading, the last one that John Spong, who was once a bishop of the Anglican Church, Archbishop of the Anglican Church in the States, is now retired, and he does talks everywhere. He does is invited to, especially people who like thinking, you know, who have universities that they have some program where you like to think rather than just learn. They do exist, you know.
Yes, they do.
and when he was still an archbishop, and the whole thing about women being ordained and homosexual marriages not being a sin, he was quite outspoken about it. He didn't see any problem with either one of those things. So that was where he first became very controversial. And then he is very much a scholar and really is a scholar of the texts, of the Jewish texts that we call the Bible. And he knows the origin of all of them, and he knows which one came first and how they were written, and that the essential Bible was made up of two different clans of Jewish people that eventually was merged together as one book. And at the time when it was done, one of the groups was more city dwellers and one was more country dwellers. And so how that history is reflected in various verses. And he knows when each of the New Testament verses were written and who copied who. And exactly where the ideas came from and why it changed. And it's really quite startling to read him and actually find yourself looking at history rather than at bias or hope or fear, but having a sense of understanding how the epic story of Judaism started being told. Mm. He compares them to the Odyssey and the Iliad of Greek writing, the beginnings of the Bible, and he says that, and that's what it is, it's an epic. And so when he comes to actually talking about beliefs and right and wrong, he's just as dogmatic as he was about that there is no reason for women not to be ordained, and there's no reason why homosexuals can't be married. He's like very dogmatic about his views. He says, you know, things that I suppose if one actually wanted to believe that a virgin could give birth, one would find him very, very scary. But if one has always wondered why you had to believe that, to believe in the power of Christ consciousness, how you had to believe that a virgin gave birth, or how she could be impregnated while she was a virgin, which is another good one. You know, like there are all these little riders in there, and be a virgin after she gave birth, which was later added to the thing, you know. It's really useful, and the thing that's most interesting to me about it is that he remains very much dedicated to the Judeo-Christian belief system, which is essentially community kindness. I know for myself, the studies I've done of Judaism is that the real focus, and you have a Jewish background, right? So you'll correct me if I'm wrong?
I'll try.
Thank you, dear. That in the Judeo-Christian, the Judeo tradition, the real focus is to do God's work on earth, for the community, to care for the community. That's what the Jewish practice is. Well, that doesn't sound like such a bad idea, does it? You know what I'm saying? It's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting to actually start looking at a book that this is such a kind and scholarly human being who brings up history in a very vivid way, and watch my own biases. I find it fascinating to read something like that. Because my biases are essentially all based on what I was told and never researched. You know, like I never even bothered figuring out whether or not Virgin Mary was a virgin. You know, but when I actually stopped and he brought it up in the book and I started thinking about it, and then, yeah, why is she a virgin? Like she gave birth, why was she a virgin after she gave birth? They didn't say she had a C-section or anything. You know? Like, yeah, I know the Buddha, you know, Buddha came out of Maya's side, but, like, we all know that's a myth to indicate his, you know. In the Buddhist tradition, there are all kinds of stories about Buddha being born an extraordinary being. And there is also scripture in the Buddhist scripture that says, by the way, a lot of these things were added because after the death of the Buddha and in the first 300 years of the teaching, when other traditions would ask why somebody was practicing Buddhism, you'd say, well, the Buddha discovered this, that, and the other. And they'd say, oh, fantastic. Was he a god? And they'd say, no. And they'd say, well, ours is a god. So there was this kind of like you're supposed to measure up in order to be respected so your temple isn't burned down, you know, and you know? Because the thing about being a human being and being self-conscious is that if somebody is different than you and then doesn't agree with you, if you're not careful, that quickly turns into paranoia and suspicion, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Mm-hmm. If you think that somebody actually, whether they did or not, somebody actually said something about you behind your back, you don't act the same way toward them, do you? Your mind is closed. You don't really know, but you just sort of start watching them and you see evidence, you know. You just happen to turn and look at them just when they look down or scratch their head. And they're like, oh, see, they're avoiding me. Isn't that true? Because when there is self-consciousness, there is also fear. The self is going to can be destroyed like that. Oh my God. What will happen to me if anything changes? Because we know there is death if we have self-consciousness. We know there is pain. We have all the stories we were told, let alone our own experiences. So how you get from self-consciousness and paranoia to self-consciousness and caring for your community, that's a big jump, isn't it? To actually truly care for your community, not finding a part of the community that you feel you fit in with and blaming the rest for not being your friends. That's a big jump, isn't it? And sometimes, you know, we make it as humans. There are moments where our collective heart actually softens and we look at our enemy and see ourselves. Like Pogo. I suppose you're all way too young. Do you not even know some of us? Any of you know who Pogo was? How many don't know who Pogo was? See, not bad, no.
Oh, I thought it was the pogo, like pogo stick.
No, pogo. No, pogo, the comic strip.
I don't know what he was, though.
He was possum. He was a possum.
Yeah.
And he was brilliant. He was one of the great philosophers of our age.
Yeah, he was.
What's that? And he had all these different figures in. One of them was the deacon, and the deacon was always dressed in this black thing, and wherever he appeared, there was a rain cloud above his head. When he walked around, the rain cloud followed him. Remember?
He spoke in Old English.
Yeah, and when he spoke, all of his words were in Old English script. And little hands pointing to certain words.
Yeah.
Like it was a brilliant comic strip. You should be able to get copies of it again.
Mm-hmm.
And one time there was this great kerfuffle, and there was an enemy somewhere, and over a series of things, eventually it ended up with Pogo entering the frame and saying, "We have found the enemy, and he is us." And that was like a classic Pogo, wasn't it? I mean, if you ever meet anybody over the age of like 60 and you just say, "Yeah, we found the enemy and he is us," they'll say, "Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, far out, yeah." Instant friendship. Because that's who the enemy is, isn't it? Us. It's who we want, but we don't want. Isn't that true? Do you think that's true?
Yes.
It's question and answer night, so I get to ask questions if you don't. So tell me something. Do you think that's true?
Yes.
Can you
have two questions?
Oh, you have questions. Oh, you're off the hook. You're off the hook. Oh, everybody, please. Everyone thanks you profusely. Please, Daisy, question me.
I just didn't want to, like, I wanted to wait for the segue.
Oh, it's now. This is it. Dim the lights, please. Yeah. Dim the light. Want the lights in? Or is it okay?
Well, I guess my first question was sort of this sense of feeling about completion and about wholeness and how to, you know, the possibility of completion or wholeness, it's, you know, where you look for that.
Isn't that interesting? Oh, I see what you're saying. I thought you were saying where does one look for completeness, or how does one define completeness?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're asking?
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at yourself, you'll see during the day how you define completeness. In the little moments, you'll see the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're frustrated because the salt shaker's been moved, or...
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And for most of us, completeness means I'm not disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that's true? I feel safe, I'm not disturbed. For some of us, for various times within that, when we feel like we're missing something, then completeness is what we don't have. So it kind of flicks between those two for most of us. Between something I don't have, or as long as I'm not disturbed, I can keep doing what I'm doing. But whether that's actually completeness, because they both depend on outer circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not within your control,
mm-hmm.
in a way. It's iffy. If something depends on conditions in order to make you feel complete,
yeah.
it's not going to last. Something's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So in Buddhism, what they do with that is they say, the faith that arises with a sense of something that makes you complete, believing in something that will make you complete, is very, very useful.
Mm.
The object is not so useful. But the faith is very useful. The sense of security or happiness with what you've got is very useful. The dullness of that is not very useful, but you can only get what you've got, so that part of it is useful. So each of them has a part of the answer. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Okay. But how you use it is different. And in the Buddhist tradition, what they say is that all beings are the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
All places are nirvana. All sounds are the divine sound.
Mm-hmm.
That samsara is not separate from nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
That you do the proper work with awareness, which means you have to be in the present moment, undisturbed, but you have to bring the faith to whatever arises is an opportunity to awaken. The faith in whatever it is that you're meeting is actually the moment of your awakening.
So sometimes you'll be meeting something that's disturbing.
But it isn't, because it's your beloved guru. So you have this sense of openness to meeting it, and the heart peaceful. Because if you're in fear about it, or dislike about it, anger about it, that thing I was saying about prejudice is going to close the mind back into ordinary anger, not wanting to be disturbed, the fear of having to do what you don't want to do is a big one, isn't it?
Mm.
People who don't like change, that's exactly what it is usually.
Mm.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that a good beginning? Do you feel
mm-hmm.
comfortable with that? You want to
mm-hmm.
go further with it? Or?
Yeah, well, it's those moments too, you know, because you feel sort of whole or complete, or like, you know, when you're in the Dharma, it's so much easier, like whether I'm in my Alexander lesson or here, or to feel a sense of wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're out there, and then there's parts that you feel are
agitated. So
and missing.
You know, disgustingly repetitive about this. And you notice that's not going to stop me this time. That whole teaching of the Buddhas, it is useful from time to time to perceive the beautiful in the unbeautiful. From time to time to perceive the unbeautiful in the beautiful. So that you give your mind the third option. You can be upset when something happens that you don't like. You can be pleased when something happens you do like. And you can be just interested in whether it's possible to dislike what you like and like what you dislike. And if you do it in little ways a lot, just in ordinary ways, you know, watch how you put your shoes on. Usually we'll put one shoe on first. I usually put my right shoe on first. So every once in a while, I just keep putting my left shoe on first. And just saying to myself, now this is the right way to put your shoes on, Cecily. You must always put them, you know. And then when I put my right shoe on, I say, oh, this is the wrong way, you know. And then I go back to the way I like doing it. And then it gets so that it's equal. And I think that's very much the kind of thing that Gurdjieff was talking about when he said, never walk the same way twice. Don't stay within your likes and dislikes. Remember when I used to ask you to put a pebble in your shoes when you walked? That was very interesting, wasn't it? Some of you put way too big pebbles in. Just a little one. So that sometimes it's between your toes and you don't feel it at all, but then it rolls back every once in a while and you just think for a moment, oh, here. Oh, I like being here. And then it rolls off again and you totally forget it, and then 3 hours later you get up and you move your foot a different ways and it rolls back again. You know, something that just every once in a while just brings you to be present and practice liking what you would usually dislike in the present and disliking what you usually like in the present. Mm-hmm. So that it keeps the mind balanced without those habitual kind of... Because most of why we feel something's missing is because of habit. And the other way to get to that point is by doing the meditation on impermanence. I think the meditation on impermanence is harder for us to do than it was, because you could go to sit beside, sitting in a place where they would take the dead bodies, and they would bring a dead body of somebody you probably knew, and then over days you would watch it rot. But now they get, you know, stuck full of fluids and beautified and open casket. And mm-hmm. So it's a different thing now. But to actually really not just have the intellectual knowledge that, you know, people die or, you know, this or that or the other, but actually have the experience of seeing how death operates and how the body returns to the earth over, you know, months and years. It's very different. So that kind of and there's so much of a push in our society for us all to be safe and taken care of and well, and you know, that we really actually feel like we're immortal, don't we? Mm-hmm. Isn't there that feeling? You know, on a plane, well, some planes crash, but not mine. But to actually pay attention and realize that it doesn't have to be a plane crash. That at this moment, this could be my last moment. And really mean that. This could be my last moment. Why is the future so important to me? It's a dream. Does that make sense? Because it is. It is a dream. And when I start actually expecting it to happen, I'm just giving food to anger, aren't I? And Lord knows, anger doesn't really need a lot of food in my being. And Cecily knows that too. Or dullness, or greed. I don't really need to feed them, they do quite well. They go grazing along through my mind quite happily, as it is. I don't need to like work with that particularly. But to work with being aware of what is in the present that is a blessing. You know, so that whole thing of playing with like and dislike, I think for our society in our time, like doing it, make a rule, do it 6 times a day. For no reason whatsoever. Okay, oh yeah. Oh yeah, I haven't done like and dislike. Okay, what's something I like here? Okay, what can I dislike here? What do I like here? What could I like? What do I dislike here? What could I like here? And just playing around with it, already it gives you a sense of not just looking at the surface of things, so therefore when you're more invested in the moment, there's less a sense of something missing. Mm-hmm. But try it and let me know. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested. I think that is just one of the most beautiful teachings the Buddha ever gave. Because it's such a core understanding for so much other stuff. So many things are rooted in our like and dislike, and we don't even notice. We don't even notice, because like and dislike aren't really important, you know? I mean, that's not, you know. But so much of the difficulty and pain in our life is just right there. You can see that, I'm hoping. Can you? And you've heard this from me more than once, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. It's repeating, though.
Oh, good. I like that.
The dripping water really works.
The dripping water does really work, doesn't it?
Are those steps too worth cultivating interest?
Just trying to do it makes interest already. Can I find something I like and what I dislike? And which one is easier, to find something I dislike and what I like, or finding something I like in what I dislike? Over the day, which one is easier? Am I more likely to be good at finding something I dislike and what I like, or finding something I like and what I dislike? I mean, who's more interesting than oneself? Like, really, you know. I mean, you know. I mean, you guys are okay, but... moi. The real story. You know.
But to push past an evaluation of something, or fear, or anger, like, does that cloud interest when those come up, and then, like, interest gets cut off?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Unless you have trained yourself to not just, you know, automatically respond. See, look, this is what happens. And again, you guys have heard this ad nauseum. You could probably recite it with me. What? When you do something you've done before, the brain releases endorphins, which do what? When you do something differently than you've done before, the brain releases what?
Adrenaline.
Which does what?
Makes you angry.
No, it makes you anxious, and then you look for the enemy. Oh, this doesn't feel right. Because I have never done this before this way, so maybe if I do it this way, I won't survive. Whereas if I do it the way I've done it before, I know I survived last time, so it must be all right. It's an automatic response, which is why people think habits are so hard to break. It's because they're addicted to the endorphins. But when you teach yourself to find what you like and what you dislike and what you dislike and what you like, then pretty soon when you change your mind about like or dislike, the brain releases endorphins because you've been repeating it. So pretty soon it feels good to change your attitude.
That's brilliant.
I know. When you actually repeat something, you know that, you know, when you started meditating, it was under protest, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But there came a certain point where if you didn't sit, you felt antsy. Because even though your mind still had the habitual thought, oh yeah, I gotta sit, when you actually sat every day and you survived it, then the next day you sat, a few endorphins get released, so when you don't sit, it's like, But you know, if you believe your thoughts, rather than seeing them as essentially empty, they're empty. It's just the old tape in the elevator, you know, nobody's changed it. So those hits from the 50s are still playing, you know, or the 60s, or the 70s, or the 80s, you know, depending on your age. Same old tapes keep playing, don't they? I mean, maybe you break away every once in a while and get a few new tapes in, but it's only a matter of time before, you know, it goes back to its default setting. And you don't just quite notice. So you actually have to put a little effort into it and actually pay attention, like, because it's not the thoughts that are important. The thoughts are habitual. It's the same with naming something. You know, I was talking about this last night. What is this? What is it?
A lid.
A lid. How do you know it's a lid?
Because it fits on the cup.
But how do you know it fits on the cup?
Since I found it.
But when did you find it? Did you know it before that? Did you know it was a lid when you first saw it?
No.
When did you first see it?
First saw it.
Are you sure? Which cup? When was the first time you saw a lid? Ever?
Okay, teapot.
When was the first time you ever saw a lid? How old were you the first time you saw a lid? Did you know it was a lid then? Did you know it was a lid then? I mean, it could have been a hat. Couldn't it? It probably was, if you thought about it, you know. So now every time you see a lid, as everybody else says lid, you say, pass me that lid. You say, what lid? Do you mean this hat? That's a thought. Based on past experience. It's not in the present. It's the old movies. I mean, if you feel like you have already attained as much as you want to, or if you feel that your life is starting to get like there's something missing, maybe you should quit listening to your thoughts so much. What a concept is that? You know? And start bringing your wake-up awareness into the present and see if there's a new thought floating around. Something new you can learn the name of. And we're so in love with our thoughts, but they're just like pure narcissism, rearview mirror, you know, and focus totally on what you thought yesterday.
So thoughts are what occupies your brain when you don't want to be in the present.
I'm not going to go that far, but I'm saying habitual thought is basically the past. Repetitive patterns. And if you actually in meditation, you know that exercise, you know in meditation you find yourself thinking?
Yes.
And you remember that exercise I told you several years ago, that when you're sitting and you find thoughts are coming and you have some degree of calm and you notice that you keep thinking, and the next time you find yourself coming to the end of a thought, because that's usually when you become aware, isn't it? When the thought's sort of winding down.
Right.
Because you're sort of not addicted by the train ride anymore. And it's starting to slow down. The station's here and you sort of come to. And, oh yeah, wait, where am I? Oh yeah, I'm meditating, right? And so when it is starting to come down, you like really try to really focus on it, but without grabbing it. Because if you grab it, that'll trigger out more thoughts. Right? But like try to really just be interested in it as if you're really trying to figure out if that actor is Ben Kingsley or, you know. You understand? You're not changing any of the story, but there's like you want to catch and see if you can catch the last thought in the series where the mind has got its satisfaction. And when you can get that thought, then say, what was the thought just before it? And what was the thought just before? And what was the thought just before? Go back, four thoughts. And you have to be quite calm to do this, because if you don't, at any one of those going back, your mind will leap off on another one and you'll be on another parachute ride before you can, you know. But when you can actually trace back four thoughts, not the whole circle, but just the last four, because you get a thought, and then an emotion will come from that thought, and the emotion will trigger the next picture. And an emotion will come from that, and it'll trigger the next picture.
So you want to go back to the four pictures?
You just want to go back to four.
Yeah.
There's probably 100.
Yeah,
you just want the last four. And when you actually are able to go back to the last four, then what you do is try to go forward to the 4, 3, 2, back to the last one. You want to teach yourself to just see, and again, every time you start doing that, the mind will want to leap off on another, you know, jump tracks and go in another direction. And when you can do that, it gets to a point, and you just have to be interested, and it's like, it's a real fine balance. Mm-hmm. When you can do that, when you can go back and forth so that you can pretty well track those four thoughts, If you don't do it, just drop it and just carry on with your practice. Next time some thought, don't worry, there will be more thought. It's a guarantee. Yeah, I knew you were a little worried there, Bob. It's all right. And when you can actually do four back and four forward, then what you do is you say, okay, so we'll call the last one one. One, two, three, four. You're going back four. The fourth thought. What was the emotion, that motive that went from the fourth thought to the third thought? Third the thought. What was the motive that went from the third to the second? Because what's interesting about thought is the motive. That's what's live about it. The thought's just a crappy set. But the plot, that's interesting. And don't get frustrated. You know, don't think that you got to get it or you're doing it right or wrong, because that's just another series of thoughts. If it doesn't work, right, quick, go back to your, if you're watching the breath or whatever, go back to your meditation. Do you remember me telling you this before?
Mm-hmm. Not quite like that, though.
I know, I get smarter every class.
Oh.
No. It's very interesting to do that. Do you have something you wanted to ask?
Yeah. Can you tell me again why people change when I do my meditation? Why do people get better?
Yeah, isn't that curious?
Yeah,
I don't know why. Every time I do a retreat, everybody is so much nicer.
Yeah. I don't even do a retreat. I just do 20 minutes a night for 3 nights. And
everybody is so nice. Yeah, they're so nice.
Everybody's friendly, and everybody's friendly towards me. If I don't do it...
They're real bastards, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I get just as bad.
Well, I don't believe that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I get... Yeah. I have to work that out.
You probably get irritated by their negativity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's probably what happens.
Yeah.
I think that's probably where it is.
Yeah.
How curious is that? I don't know. I'm still trying to work that one out. Every time I do a retreat, I come out, you guys are like angels. You just ask such intelligent questions, and it's like... And we have such a good time together. We never feel frustrated. It's wonderful.
No, but a retreat, you're doing it for like 7 days or 10 days or something. I do this for 20 minutes.
Yeah, same thing though.
it's coming to the point is driving me crazy.
But you know that old saying, if I don't meditate for 1 day, I notice. If I don't meditate for 2 days, my enemies notice. If I don't meditate for 3 days, everybody notices.
But they really want to pick on you.
Yeah, because even 20 minutes is enough to center the consciousness. If you do more than that, that's even better. But 20 minutes
is enough. It's getting up to the 20 minutes. Like it takes a day or two to get up to 20 minutes, and then it goes 20 to 30.
Yeah.
And sometimes you fall asleep, but you wake up and you're sitting there and you say, why am I not in bed?
Oh, right, I'm meditating.
Yeah, right, I'm meditating.
Yeah.
It's all right. I can
meditate.
I can do this.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not a matter of the performance, is it? It's a matter of doing it.
Yeah. And whether
it's a good meditation. One of the things that I really look forward to is when people come to give me a meditation report or ask me, and they no longer say, well, I didn't do a good meditation or I did a bad meditation. It's like, oh... Hallelujah. They've gone past performance and they're just sitting. You know, whether you fall asleep or don't fall asleep, whether you're thinking or not thinking, that's not the point. You're a human being.
Yeah, and I require less sleep.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Things are nicer and you're not so dull.
Yeah.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. I have to quit thinking about it and just do it.
Why don't you try that and see what the next change will be?
Would you say that again?
Why don't you try that and see what the next change will be? How that changes people. I think you'd probably be okay. I think you'd be okay. I think so, Bob.
Well, I don't know if they'll be okay, though. They can all be on the same level. You know, around that place, it would be a good thing.
You don't know. Well, it's worth a try. Did you get satisfactorily answered with that, that one question? And you had another question?
Yeah, it's about sort of doing the clear light meditation before bed. And so what I've been noticing is that kids are funny, actually. So you're doing the, you know, I'm thinking of the light, and then as I'm doing my going to sleep.
Where is the light?
Well, see, that's the thing. As I sit there and I do my prayers, and then I do the I'm Amitabha, and then the light's filling my body, and then this has been going on for, like, every time I do it, I'm like, okay, so where did it go? I mean, so I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe I'm noticing how it's like you just get knocked out like that, like you just get knocked out. It seems, it's like, it feels like when people say, you know, they had the medicine, Demerol, or going for operation, they're like 99, 90, 98, 90. So I'm like, okay, so where are the light? Where is the light? Am I supposed to be, you know?
Yeah, sometimes it helps. You set up the light, and then you give yourself something to watch, because what happens is that when you go to sleep, the awareness is still present, but there is a... I was talking about this. Was that last night I was talking about this? Or
night before.
Night before, right. On Thursday night I was talking about this, was it? When the mind, when you go to sleep, the mind is still aware. As you go, switch from awake to asleep, you can feel the body's rhythms changing. You can feel the breath change. You can feel, it's like when you go to sleep, the cleaning crew comes in, and the liver works differently, and you know, the whole body goes on a different system. And so you can be aware of that shift over. But usually when that shift over is about to start, then the sense of self doesn't feel comfortable, and so clicks out, just goes, I'm not here, and dives into sleep.
But
you can train yourself to watch that, and then the mind, the awareness will, the consciousness will go deeper and deeper into sleep. Then when it goes into deep sleep, there's no awareness. But that really is just like sinking. It's not like sudden or anything. There's a feeling of going deeper and deeper, like light dimmer switch, really slow, going down. It's not sudden. And then when that mind comes out of deep sleep to go to dream state, to the rhythm changes to view the dream state, or to turn over or do something like that, then you can be aware of it again. When I do retreats, I'm usually very aware right through the night. I can watch those states. When I'm not on retreat, there are two techniques that I have found worked. The one I'm using at the moment is a combination of imaging light in myself, imaging myself wanting to have this awareness not only for myself but for all beings, imaging all beings also being connected with me by that light, and then putting my focus either on my throat, or I usually combine the two methods that I have been taught. I put my awareness on the throat, but I'm really sort of just holding the feeling of the throat, and I'm actually trying to just subtly watch the breath from the throat, believe it or not. And I was actually taught do one or the other, but for some reason I'm doing both, and it's probably against all the rules, so don't copy me unless it works for you. And I put my awareness on the throat, and traditionally it's taught that there's a red light there, mm-hmm. but for me the red light was too awakening and a blue light worked better. Mm-hmm. So a soft blue light there. Mm-hmm. And then just watching the mind goes off. Usually for most of us we have a way of thinking before we fall asleep that makes us feel safe, our habitual way of thinking. So when your mind starts going off on a thought pattern, you know you must be starting to go to sleep. So just really gently, without any kind of judgment or anything, just bring it back to the breath or to the throat. You can also just watch the breath. And just, Rinpoche used to have us try to see whether we went to sleep on the in-breath or the out-breath, his tricky way of getting us to watch the breath while we fell asleep, you know. Or Ananda Bodhi used to do that. Yeah. I think Rinpoche did it a few times too. They were very similar in a lot of ways, those two. And then, whatever it is you're watching, either the throat or the breath, and you just try to be aware. I find the breath is easier in the beginning because there is actually a change in the pattern as you're going into mm-hmm. sleep, mm-hmm. And there's usually, if you're watching the breath rather than your mind is safely stowed on the usual way that you drop into it in one of the usual thought patterns you do. Some people, they review everything they're going to do the next day, and so it bores them so much they fall asleep quite nicely that way. And some people review everything they did today, and that bores them so much that they fall asleep. You know? But whatever it is, it makes you feel safe so that you don't have to be present to watch yourself fall asleep because you're mm-hmm. surrendering. Mm-hmm. When you fall asleep, you're surrendering. The ego consciousness is surrendering. Mm. So we don't like that. Mm. We don't like that. But yet, in meditation, that's what you're teaching yourself to do. When there is no subject-object, like if your face back to your mother, your bones back to your father, your bones back to your mother, your face back to your father, who are you then? That's the question, and that's what this is doing. It's getting you to let go of subject-object identity and what is consciousness at that point. So holding a focus that you can watch for the difference in your breathing or the difference in your awareness, very subtle. There's a point just before you actually let go and go under the surface of sleep where there is a sort of slightly more awareness, slightly more and there's a tendency to jump into thought then, or jerk and wake up. Mm-hmm. You know that one? Mm-hmm. So then you know, oh, I almost got it that time. And you just bring your mind back softly. You don't move your position or think it was the pillow or wonder who broke in or anything. Oh, I almost. Because as you were just going through that transition and then the ego consciousness went, I can't watch this. Beep, jerk. Who's that? Is somebody here? Yes, I'm here. And I was almost here. But now I'm here again. Okay, mm-hmm. How could I get back here? Mm. Is this helping?
Yep.
So, like, I was given, I was asked to do a lot of dream yoga at one time, and you have to watch your mind go into dream and then come out of it. Mm-hmm. And I was given, first of all, the red light and then the blue light. And then I was told to experiment with what worked best for me, and I found that the breath sometimes worked, and sometimes the red light, sometimes the blue light, sometimes just the feeling of the warmth of the throat worked. So I'm suggesting don't cling too hard to a rule, but try to find a place where you feel like you can hold some awareness mm-hmm. without grasping at an object. Right. More like you're following a thread and the thread is going somewhere, not that it's fixed in one place. Because the important thing is to be able to sync with the awareness. Mm-hmm. Not hold in one place.
Yeah,
do you get a feeling of it?
Yeah, because I think it's grasping at the object.
Yeah.
Because I remember she went, you know, it's like, it's trying to get something which is actually
the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The opposite.
What you want to do is the thread is actually a traveling thread, and you want to move with the thread.
Mm-hmm.
So play with it a little bit more with that idea,
mm-hmm.
and don't try to do it right.
Yeah.
Don't try to do it right.
Yeah.
And you'll know because you won't know. You'll be aware, but you won't know whether you're asleep or awake.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get excited or try to figure that out. Just be aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And just see whether, you know, is there a slight shift in the perception of being, of the body, of being, but don't go with the body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just go for a textural shift.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll get it. You'll get it. Oh, that must be it. Usually you get it just when you have to be kind of relaxed.
Yeah.
But it's very nice. And if you're successful in that, it's not unlikely that you will watch yourself wake up to a dream and watch the sequence of pictures for the dream,
mm-hmm.
and then watch the going right down. Or if you have a sequence of pictures and then the dream excites you, watch the story start to build as the consciousness comes more toward awakening.
Because
mm-hmm. the story is made separate from the dream images.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been interesting just to watch how it's
fascinating.
Got knocked out. Like,
yeah.
Since I'd never noticed how, you know, you're like, it really literally, you know, night after night, it's just, you know, knockout. Yeah.
I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So playing is nice.
Yeah.
And sometimes the resistance will cause you to just be knocked out. Because it's, like I said, it's threatening to the sense of self.
Yeah,
so what you might want to do is, like, for a long time, I slept half sitting up and slightly cool, so that I couldn't be quite so comfortable, because that helped me knock out better.
Mm.
It dulled me a bit, so I went right with that.
Mm.
And then when you wake up, just as you're waking up, think as much, as quick as you're able to hold your thoughts, I'm waking into a dream. And when you wake up and you're looking around saying, this is a dream.
Mm.
So that there's less difference between sleep and wake, so you can watch it better.
Mm.
Because it is a dream.
Mm-hmm.
What people who meditate in those boxes, meditation boxes, for long periods of time? Is there a...
I only ever saw one person who was doing that in India, and I never could really talk to him. So I don't know what they're doing.
I just got the sense, as you were talking, of just that whole feeling of sitting, once the body is calm and relaxed, just
yeah, you could do that, but then you have to pee, and you know, and then the circulation will stop in your limbs, and you know, and then you'll get gangrene in your toes, and you know, it works better as a story, is my experience.
But you have to pee when you sleep too, and the body just.
I'm saying to stay in a box for a long time and just...
Oh, yeah. No, I was just... I had that image of that box, like a friend's place.
Oh, yeah, like that.
Yeah. And there was the lady who did Cave in the Snow.
Yeah, that's a common way. And you have a cord for sleeping.
Ah.
So you have a cord that holds your knees up. It's quite more like a belt than a cord. And goes behind you, and you.
It'd be almost like you're in one of those hammock things.
Yeah, like one of those hanging chair hammock things. Yeah, those I've seen, but there was this man in India who hadn't come out of his box for some years. And the first time we went to India with Ananda Bodhi, we went to see this guy. I shouldn't say this on tape.
You can tell us.
Then afterwards, Ananda Bodhi said, somebody was saying, wow, that's pretty incredible, eh, sir? And he said, well, I don't know, some of you haven't, he's only not left his box for 6 years. Some of you haven't left your box your whole lives. Damn, he was right. Damn. That wasn't bad to say.
I could ask a practical question. How did you eliminate his bodily functions?
I don't know. I couldn't talk to him, like I said. You know, he was just a revered saint for the fact that he had been in that box for 6 years. That he was eating. I'm sure they had some way of doing it. Because it didn't stink that bad or anything. And I was young and naive in those days, so I wouldn't have gone in like this. So. Yeah, all those different practices, those different techniques like dream yoga, they're really worth exploring. If nothing else, you'll find out how difficult they actually are, and how little you do know about yourself, and how habituated you are, and how dull that makes you. Because you know how much of your life you spend sleeping. You do know? At least a third, right?
One third. Even when I'm not sleeping.
That sort of half-dosing?
Well, you know that feeling you think you're there, and then, but all of a sudden, something rolls, and you go, oh, all right.
Okay.
You know, so yeah. And then you don't remember where you were, you don't remember why you're standing in the kitchen, looking at the fridge, or whatever.
All us old ladies are saying, geez, we didn't know that was happening to you, too. Yeah. Right, June? Right, June? Oh, wow, that happens at your age? Sleep, I never thought of that. But it's true, you know. I wish we would all wake up and say, what are we doing? And maybe with our good friendship we'll do that. I am depending on you. That's a scary thought, isn't it?
Big responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, bet you thought you were just here for entertainment and bad jokes. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? I like your questions.
I've had a question about yab yum. I don't know what the question is exactly. It's, sometimes it comes up as I look at the DVD picture of Rajasattva, but the single one, it's I look at the deity of the yab yum, and that's more resonating for me. And just there the words come up in my mind, and go, what is that? What does it feel like? And then I get sort of feelings in the body of, I don't know, maybe male and female, or up and down, or pumps moving. Talk a bit about that?
Sure, I mean, when you do a highest yoga tantra initiation, the first initiation is understanding the five aggregates as deity. The second is as not self and therefore deity. And the five poisons, five aggregates, five poisons, how to use them rather than be used by them. The second initiation has to do with the nature of mind. The third initiation has to do with the nature of consort. And the consort is where you are. The knowing, self-conscious state in union with the state of being. And when you treat that appropriately, then the consort is the blissful orgasm of awakening. So when you are actually in the here and now, treating it as your beloved, your guru, your great benefactor, the greatest love of your life, regardless of what it is, with your full open heart, because you have nothing to lose, which you can only do if you're in the present, can you? It's your consort. That's the Abhyam. It's like the high priestess and the magician.
Yeah, I was thinking of the cross.
That's right. That's what it is.
That's really cool.
And then there is the fourth initiation, of which I have not spoke. And once you have some practice of being able to work with your habitual reactions to the present, and know that whatever arises is your guru, whatever arises is your guru, whatever arises is your guru, is the path to transcendence. Once you have practice with that, then you can start actually practicing orgasmic energy with a partner. But instead of having the climax, you use each other to rev the energy up, and then you take it up to rather than, you know, go with the outer orgasm, you take it up the spine. So that's when the tantric sex trip comes in. But first, it requires the discipline of being able to treat the moment. So a lot of the times you see these conferences where people are learning how to do tantric sex. And, well, they're learning how to have a good fuck. But it's not tantric sex. They're learning how to really use that orgasmic thing for an orgasmic thing. But tantric sex is a whole other issue.
Could that happen between people just on a totally emotional level without the sexual thing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It can happen in your own being.
Yeah.
Without another person, and in fact, that I can speak from my own experience. It is certainly possible to have a greater orgasm in meditation than one can have in the physical, and I was no stranger to good orgasms. So, but you have to actually be willing to be present with your whole heart. And for most of us, that's a bit of a struggle. Because there's some part of ourselves we hate, or we don't trust, or we're afraid, or, you know? You have to love the pimples on your backside. And then it's no problem. Did you miss me talking Dharma dirty like this, Bob?
Yeah, it is. It's so lonely up there.
Other questions, Cecily? If a person believes that what we believe we manifest, is that a trap sort of into a bit of an ego-creating story following that way, or is it wholesome to follow that thought, that what we believe we manifest?
The there's this movie going around that perhaps some of you have heard, The Secret. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my friends, especially my younger friends, have discovered it. And it basically, that is the strongest statement in that movie, that according to your thoughts, that's what happens. And there is a very strong truth in that. What is left out is that sense of who is the I. You know, to actually try to find the I that has a thought or the I that manifests something. You know, and that part is not questioned. And so, like, if you're going to wonder whether it's true that what we believe we manifest, you know, that could very well be true, but who is the I? Is there an I? You know, where is the I that's believing something? You know, how many different beliefs are riddled through your being? You know? There's a part of me that absolutely believes the Conservative Party has some really good things to say for it. There's another part of me that thinks the Liberals are where it's at. There's another part that goes green all the way. And there's an NDP there pretty goddamn small and strong too. Right? Well, God blessed, maybe. Let's make that blast. Blast. So like, which I? On one hand, I want something. On the other hand, I don't want something. I really wish everything could change as long as I could stay the same. isn't that it? Exactly? So, but do you see that there is a part of your I that believes this and another I who doesn't believe this? That's what I'm saying. I really want to change as long as I can stay the same. I really want to learn to meditate, Cecily, because I really want to change some of my views and the way things are happening in my life, but I really don't want to, you know, sit for 20 minutes a day. Because I don't have the time to do that. I'm too busy collecting complaints. Can you make collecting complaints into a meditation for me, please? Could you design a meditation that I could call a meditation that doesn't change any of my patterns in the day? Is that asking too much? I thought you Buddhists were good at meditation. That makes sense? You know, you can see that. So who is the I there? You know? What is the I? You know, there's one I that wants this, one I that wants that, one I that... So in one moment, the sense of I changes, but the idea of I feels like a constant. Doesn't it? I'm certainly not the I that walked in the door who was belching and burping and mad. You know, for some reason I start talking Dharma to you people and I all of a sudden feel great. You know? How does that happen? You know? How does that happen? Are you the same I that was talking to James?
No.
How does that happen? So which I is shaping which behavior? You know? Is there time, because there's so many I's, is there time for all of them to manifest? And would I notice them, because it'd be flashing around. It's like one of those impossible questions, you know?
No, that's good. Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? And there's a fatalism about it that's just too much of a catch-22 for me to go there.
No, it grounds it enough for me.
But yeah, but you understand what I mean about the fatalism. Because, like, you know, I remember when I lived on Pender Island, which is just a beautiful place to live. Perhaps you've ever been to the Gulf Islands? I'm not sure. Once or twice, haven't you? Remind me of somebody I met there, only a very different, very different person. But anyway. And I got to know the community quite well, and there was quite a large Wicca, women who were practicing Wicca, and a couple of men in there too. It was full moon, and we were doing a Wicca thingy, And I was giving one of my other friends was going to that too, and it was a potluck Wicca thingy for full moon. You know, it wasn't a Buddhist thingy; it was a Wicca thingy. And my friend had recently broken her arm. I was going with. So I said, "Well, I'll drive," because she lived a bit away. So I was going to walk, but then she wanted to come with me. So I went and picked her up, and we drove there. And we got there, and we walk in, and we got our things, and you know, this woman comes in with her cast, and the Wicca thingy lady said, "Oh, what happened to you?" And she said, "Oh, I broke my arm." He said, "Well, that's your karma." And it's like, as if we were little cookie cutters. Okay, you're this shape, and this is going to happen. You know, as if that were true, as if there were no communal mind that had karma, or planetary mind that had karma, as if everything had its own little, as if we were a mechanical machine, you know, and when the spindle goes weird, then the whatever shuttle goes funky, and you know. Mm-hmm. Do you understand how ridiculous that is when you actually look at it? How can there be my karma? If there is an action, we're all in it together. Oh, you just breathed some of my oxygen. Did you see that? Oh, you used my word there.
Well, I took some of her.
Oh, well. You know, like it's like when you actually look at it, the whole idea of separation or an actual individual that never merges or blends to another aspect within your being or outside your being is like totally ridiculous. We're all breathing each other's skin in all the time. Aren't we? Mm-hmm. As far as I know. Some of you have really nice skin. Is that useful? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just wouldn't go there. Yeah. It's like way too mechanical. It's like when people say that was meant to be. That's a phrase that I have used to imagine something I like and what I dislike. Sometimes I'm successful. When someone utters those words around me, sometimes I can think, why they have lovely pronunciation. It's one of those phrases, you know. Was meant to be, oh yeah, who's the bookkeeper? It's a chess game, is that what we're doing here? No, my friends. Every moment is a potential. Every moment, everything is possible. There are results from past actions and, in the moment, a possibility. The lightning can always strike. But it doesn't have to. If you don't know how to pray to the weather gods, shame on you. Because you've been living in this earth long enough to learn. Oh, that was meant to be. I don't think that's exactly an educated statement. That sounds more like superstition to me. And limited. And unkind. Just a quick way of saying, oh, I'm glad that asshole got it rather than me. You know? Yeah. Or, well, I deserve this. I deserve every bit of this. Yeah. So, is that an adequate sufficiency for this evening? Have I lectured you enough? Mm-hmm. Adrea's birthday is on the 28th?
28th.
Of this month.
Mm-hmm.
I dare us all to send her a birthday card. The funnier, the better. She likes funny things. She said she wanted some funny books.
Some funny books?
About a year ago, like joke books, funny ones. Adrea's birthday is on the 28th. I think we should start sending them to her a week before her birthday. Present or card a day. As many as possible
on
her birthday, and then a few straggling in afterwards. Yiffa, yiffa, yiffa. I think it was meant to be.
It's her karma.
It's her karma. For having such good friends.
So her dogma can meet our karma.
Her dogma, yeah, it's going to be run over by our karma. And it's going to get cheetah all over the road. Is that it then?
I would just like to say how much I'm really enjoying my new knees.
That's so wonderful, Bob.
And to acknowledge everybody that was there for me over the years.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just having a great time.
Oh, that's so
wonderful.
Every
morning I get up, I walk to work and I say,
I'm walking to work.
12 hours later, I turn around and I walk back and it doesn't hurt.
Oh, sweetheart.
It's just a riot.
Oh, that's just so great.
Everybody should have new knees. Even if you don't need them, get new ones. They don't hurt.
That's brilliant,
no,
isn't it?
It's fantastic.
That's just brilliant.
Yeah, I can't believe it. Every day is a new day.
That is so great.
Yeah. I have people say to me at work that, you know, it was painful to watch you walk across the shop.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, how the hell you did it. Hurt, no.
Because they were it was the way you did it.
Yeah. Prozac is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And new knees are even better.
Oh, my knees are better than Prozac, yeah. I don't even think about that anymore.
That's so great.
No, yeah, it's just a whole new life.
I'm so happy for you.
Yeah.
It's really neat.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
Thank you too.
Can I borrow your knees?
Get your own.
Oh, I'll put you on the list. I just say you can't. Nobody's seen a U-Haul drug behind a hearse yet. I keep thinking, you know, why would it be an idea? I'll put my knees in my hearse and drag it behind me.
You're not going to do it twice, are you? Wasn't that enough? Well, just in case, I see. Yeah, okay, across the river, I'm taking the raft with me. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? So you notice this extremely beautiful gold light in your hearts. And it just shines through your body. Fills your whole body. Your whole body is like gleaming with light. And if your eyes are closed, open them a little bit so you can see through your eyelashes. Just notice little sparks of light everywhere, shining out from your body. The walls and the floor and the ceiling are just dancing consciousness, gold light. It fills the whole house. Moves out through the night. Above, below, and in front and behind, right there, four quarters. Fills the whole city of Edmonton. Just moves out through the whole world. Anyone you want to pray for, and inspire. Thank you for your great compassion.